Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick. And today we are going to be talking about the 1978 gothic horror adaptation of Beauty and the Beast, or Pána a Netvor, the Czech version by the director Juraj Hertz. Rob, I think this is only the second adaptation I've ever seen of the Beauty and the Beast tale, the original being the Disney Beauty and the Beast, which just a couple of years ago I watched for the first time since childhood, and I thought, oh, surprisingly good. Or I don't know if it should be surprising. I don't know. I haven't revisited the Disney movies as much as an adult as many other people I know, but I was impressed. And you know what? I'd say two for two. This one's really good too.
Yeah. I, like you, I haven't seen a ton of Beauty and the Beast adaptations. It's a story I'm very familiar with. And certainly the Disney animated film from, what was it, 91? Mm-hmm. That one casts a long shadow. I mean, that's one that a lot of us grew up with. And I would never say that was like my favorite Disney musical of all time, but it's pretty solid. And as we'll discuss perhaps in a bit here, like even the Disney version has some nice additions to this story. I should go ahead and mention, just as long as we're talking about Beauty and the Beast in general, the French novelist Jean-Marie Le Prince de Beaumont, who lived 1711 through 1780, wrote the best known version of Beauty and the Beast, which itself was an abridged telling based on an earlier version and other earlier versions of it. Her version of the tale greatly streamlined things. For instance, one of the previous versions of the story had the merchant widower's children numbering something like 12. She cut that down to 6, 3 sons and 3 daughters. So she did a lot of economic trimming to the story. So a lot of the versions, the cinematic versions then, of Beauty and the Beast, stem from her novelization.
Okay, well, this version trims it down even more because this has a merchant widower with 3 daughters, one of which is the protagonist of the story, Julie in this rendering, but I guess that would be equivalent to Belle in the Disney version. But I think it's funny that the Disney one pares it down even more, just one daughter from what I recall, right? She doesn't have any sisters, does she?
I don't think she does. Yeah, that 1991 animated film, Robbie Benson voiced the Beast. One of the great things that film added to the story was adding the Gaston character, the overly masculine competitor for Belle's affections that ultimately becomes the proper villain of the piece. And that's something that I think, you know, looking at some of these other adaptations, I mean, that's kind of missing. Like the Beast begins as sort of the antagonist, but then is this more complicated figure at the center of the story. Gaston, besides adding some additional comic flair and a really solid musical number, he provides that villain, a proper foil for the Beast in the latter portions of the film.
I remember thinking upon rewatching it, it was kind of interesting that Gaston and the Beast were both two stereotypical ways that that sort of men can go wrong, and the difference was that the Beast was able to change and Gaston was not.
That's right. Yeah. Now, I haven't seen the 2017 live action adaptation of the Disney musical, but Dan Stevens plays the Beast in that one.
You know, the other big change in the Disney one is that they make the father, I think, an inventor instead of a merchant. So in both cases, he's kind of, both these movies I've seen, he's kind of bumbling. But whereas in the Disney one, he's making like a wood chopping machine or something. He's trying to build robots. And in this movie, he's just losing lots and lots of money with terrible business deals.
Yeah, I forgot about the inventor twist in the Disney animated version.
That is a really good one. But Panna Netvor, or the Czech Beauty and the Beast, has a lot of wonderful, unique charms of its own. And I would say one of them is the vision of the Beast. Now, like I said, I haven't seen more than two of these Beast adaptations. But this one, I think, may have the most unique Beast design of any of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And should we go ahead and spoil what the Beast looks like? Or should we save that?
Let's save it for when we discuss the plot. We can reveal it at the same time it happens in the chronology.
All right. We'll go ahead and just mention in passing. We're not going to do a complete analysis of all the different adaptations of Beauty and the Beast over the years, but I wanted to touch on some of them, in large part just to focus on how the Beast is visually realized. And one of the key ones here, and this is a highly regarded film that I'm slightly embarrassed to say that I've never seen, is the 1946 adaptation from Jean Cocteau. This is the black and white Beauty and the Beast. And I think that one of the reasons I've never watched it is I'm always a little distracted by how the Beast looks on like the cover art, because the Beast, it looks impressive. I'm not saying it looks shabby. It looks like a werewolf sort of effect, a wolfman effect, but also he's in just very frilly clothing. He looks kind of like a pampered dog in a fancy outfit.
He looks like a soft, friendly buddy. He's kind of a cotton ball. He looks also a bit like the Cowardly Lion from Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, definitely there is a Cowardly Lion feel to this as well. But again, this is a highly regarded film. It's considered a classic. So I haven't seen it, so I can't really say any more about it. But I just want to say that I'm not trashing this film. I just have not seen it. And for some reason or another, the appearance of the Beast has always kind of prevented me from watching it.
Well, he's got whiskers, so I think that makes him look like the lion. But also the way the fangs come out over the bottom lip, like they are producing a fanged overbite, but it's like the fangs are not long enough to look scary, so instead they look kind of cute.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just it's kind of hard to put a finger on, but for some reason this has always given me pause. All right, so I'm going to be jumping around in time here on some of these, but the other adaptation I was excited to acknowledge was one that I don't think I was even aware of this, but I noticed that Michael Weldon mentioned it in one of his psychotronic guides. And there are several weird things coming together here. So Shelley Duvall's Fairy Tale Theater was apparently a show in the mid-1980s.
Pause.
Yeah. I don't remember this being on. I don't know where this aired. I don't know at what how Shelley Duvall became the face of this, if this was like a European show and then Shelley Duvall became the host when it was aired in America, and why Shelley Duvall, like why is she sort of the storyteller or crypt keeper of fairy tale theater?
Wait, I said pause. Okay, I'm trying to look this up. there's no way I can catch up on this. This is a revelation. Thank you for sharing this with me.
All right, so I'm only going to focus on one episode of it, because one episode of it was Beauty and the Beast from 1984. First of all, it was directed by Roger Vadim, who directed Barbarella and such films as Spirits of the Dead. And the Beauty is played by Susan Sarandon.
Okay.
Angelica Houston is apparently in it as well, though I couldn't find any stills of her, so I'm not sure if that is like a crediting error or if she does in fact have a role in it. But Susan Sarandon, at least, is Beauty. And then the Beast is played by Klaus Kinski.
Ooh.
Yeah. Which I've watched a few sequences from this, and I've got some stills here for you, Joe. They seem to very much go after that 1946 feel with the Beast, because again, it looks like a hairy wolfman type creature with a lot of frilly costuming,
but also a very permed hair quality to the Beast's head. This is a hair metal beast. Like he could have been in Cinderella.
Yeah.
The band, not the story.
Yeah, and at the same time, this beast does look frightening. Like, the Kinskiness certainly shines through, and I'm afraid of the monster. Likewise, the footage that I pulled up, and then also stills you can find of Kinski at the end of the film, when he's been transformed back into a human prince, equally, if not more, frightening. Because here he is standing next to Susan Sarandon. Everything's supposed to be blissful and beautiful, but this is clearly Klaus Kinski. And yes. I'm not used to seeing Klaus Kinski as anything other than an actual monster or just a monstrous character. And here he is as this, glowing prince. And I'm just not buying it for a second. Like, get away from him, Susan Sarandon.
Exactly. Hilarious. So your soft, cuddly, fuzzy teddy bear beast is transformed back into the charming prince who is Klaus Kinski.
Right. So I don't know. I may have to go back and watch that one at some point or see what else Shelley Duvall had in store for us.
Sorry, I'm just still rolling on imagining another story where the happy ending is that a teddy bear transforms into the bad guy from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, I know a number of you are already probably shouting this at your podcast playing device, but yes, we also have to consider Ron Perlman from the Beauty and the Beast TV series, which aired 1987 through 1990. It was set in then modern day New York City. I think he lived in the sewers underneath the city. Linda Hamilton played the Beauty, and George R. R. Martin was a writer and producer on the show. It was certainly a very lion themed beast here, and ultimately just really nice makeup effects. Also, definitely some hairband hair going on here.
Yeah, very much Ron Perlman in cat mode, and I think they actually almost kind of extra prettified him, extra made him like even more good looking for this role. And this is something that I think some other Beauty and the Beast adaptations suffer from. Like, maybe they don't commit enough to making the Beast look scary, to making the Beast look monstrous. I mean, you know that the Beast and the Beauty are going to fall in love in the end. There's a temptation to kind of make the Beast too handsome. This is not a problem with the 1978 movie we are talking about today.
No, they commit hard to making the Beast loathsome and dangerous looking. But yeah, this Ron Perlman version of the Beast, like, this is the character that launched a thousand furries. It has to be. I mean, this is a good looking Beast man.
Yeah, I mean, if you're into people who look like cats, this guy's top of the heap.
Yeah. Now, another really good-looking, I think, a very stylish beast. This is not one I've seen, but there was apparently a 1987 Canon Films musical adaptation of Beauty and the Beast starring John Savage as the Beast. I've included an image here. And Rebecca De Mornay as the Beauty. As you can see, it looks very glamorous. It looks a little, say, Sting-esque.
I totally see that. Looks again like they're trying to make the Beast too handsome.
Now, I have a question mark for the 1976 TV adaptation Beauty and the Beast that starred George C. Scott as the Beast. I'm not sure offhand who played the Beauty, but Patricia Quinn of Rocky Horror is in it, I think, in a bit role. But the Beast in this film, again, played by George C. Scott, they decided, well, we've done the Wolfman look to death. Let's do something different. Let's make him look like a warthog.
Yep, he's a wild boar with, like, tusks coming up out of the bottom of his nose, around his nose, but above his mouth.
Or, I don't know, maybe his lip kind of curves around there. I didn't watch any footage from this one, so I don't know what the apparatus looks like in motion. This one also is a lot to take in.
He also does look like George C. Scott.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you pay for George C. Scott, you don't want to hide all of that, right?
Beast getting hit by football.
Now, it is an interesting question. Like, if you're doing Beauty and the Beast, or as with our next two examples, things that are Beauty and the Beast adjacent, like, what are you focusing on here? Are you focusing on, like, the love story about the transformative nature of love, about the, like, the duality of man? Or is it something a little more, like, purely erotic, and you just like the idea of beast creatures and women, you know, in close proximity to one another?
Right. I could see how you could go either way. I mean, I think the two adaptations I've seen both focus more on how love can change someone who has a bad personality. Mm-hmm. Whereas in these other adaptations, yeah, you can imagine how it's just kind of like, ooh, this is dangerous. This is titillating.
Yeah. And not surprising, one of them comes from the mid-70s, the 1975 film The Beast. This is a French erotic horror film that actually has nothing to do with the plot of Beauty and the Beast, but it has a beast, it has beauties, and it has a historic setting. I saw this one when it was weirdly enough streaming into every American household on Netflix several years back. But it is not really appropriate for most viewers, maybe any viewers. It's kind of an obscene curiosity of the time.
Is this picture of the beast in the outline from that?
I believe so, yes. It has kind of like a giant humanoid rat kind of appearance.
Yes, I was going to say rat.
Yeah. Now, another one.
Also, it's kind of a perverted rat, though. Like, it's peeping over a branch at the camera.
Yeah, I mean, it's fitting. It's a perverse film. And yeah. I honestly do not recommend anyone see it, but it's kind of a notable curiosity when it comes to films of this subject matter.
All right.
Now, another film in this sort of genre, this area of beauty slash beast adaptation and inspiration, Charles Band attempted a serious erotic horror film in Meridian back in 1990. Again, this one's not based on Beauty and the Beast. It has a beauty, it has a beast, and it's notable because the story that I read is that Band essentially used an altered version of the Dracula Wolfman costume from Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh, from the Coppola movie. Yes. Yeah. So you attached a picture. I recognize that. There is a scene where Gary Oldman transforms into a wolf-like creature. And yep, that's what he looks like.
Yeah. So I believe the story is they had access through some effects guys to essentially that costume, but they realized they couldn't just use that costume, or nor did they necessarily want to, but they had to adapt it a little bit. So it's very similar, but different enough. Like, in the end, they kind of handsomed it up a little bit. They made it a little smoother. Like, they realized that, you know, we don't want him to be a complete monster. We want people to want to see these two together.
Okay, so there are a lot of Beauty and the Beast film adaptations out there, as well as some movies just loosely inspired by the Beauty Beast concept. I think this one really stands out. Beauty and the Beast 78 is the Czech film, or Czechoslovak film, is one I really enjoyed because I said at the top it was gothic horror. Now that I think back on it, I don't know if it's really horror. What do you think, Rob? Does this count as horror? I mean, it is full of horrible images, but I don't know if the primary purpose of the film is to scare you.
No, I don't think it's quite a horror film. And I wasn't sure, based on the visual flavor of the piece, I wasn't sure that was going to be the case, because certainly everything is gothic and dark and grimy enough. And we firmly establish a world, a setting at the beginning of the film in which horrible things can and will happen. But then ultimately the trajectory of the plot takes us more traditional places. Like, it sticks more to the fairy tale and essentially delivers the fairy tale with some gothic dark stylings.
And I would say especially the first half of the film is really filled with ambiance, with scary environments. This is a movie where the director really wants to let us revel in the texture of certain environments and emotions. And that leads to another stylistic aspect of it. I would say that there are long stretches of this movie without any dialogue. So I think you could characterize it, and I have seen people online characterize the movie as slow, something that audiences used to the fast-paced plotting and editing of modern movies can sometimes struggle with. But I recommend giving slow movies like this a shot if you usually don't. They can be very rewarding, a very rewarding experience if you kind of slow yourself down, like you slow down your expectations and you say, I'm just going to sit here and kind of soak in this. Because a lot of times with movies like this, the filmmakers are They're just offering you a different kind of experience than we usually expect in modern American movies today. And this is an experience where you are not always in a hurry to advance the plot in every scene. Some scenes are about inviting you to linger in a feeling.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is one of those films where you should just, you know, lay back in a dark room with it. If you have a calming beverage you like to imbibe, have that with you as well, and just let the darkness overflow.
It will invite you to rub the fur, and it is some really dank, gloomy fur, especially in the first half of the movie. We'll get into more of that about the atmosphere when we describe the plot. Let's see. I guess we've already done the elevator pitch. I mean, it is an adaptation of Beauty and the Beast, so you sort of know what you're getting, but there are some stylistic twists and maybe some plot twists we can talk about later on. Do we want to feature any trailer audio? Rob, I think before we started, you were saying that there isn't really a trailer that has much English narration or anything like that.
Not that I could find. In fact, the main trailer I came across is just blaring organ music from the film and some awesome visuals, none of which will translate over into the audio of podcasting. So I tell you what, let's just do, maybe like 10 seconds of it, because I will come back to discussing the music in a bit.
Blast away.
Now, before we proceed here, you might be wondering, well, where can I watch this film? If I want to watch it and then come back to the discussion. This one, I have to admit, might be harder to find. We watched it on the second run Blu-ray rented from Atlanta's Videodrome video rental store. I'm sure you can find some unofficial streams out there, but I can't find any official ones as of this recording. So I would say keep checking, because stuff comes online and goes offline. But as of right now, Criterion Collection has some of the films by this director, but not this particular one. So who knows, in the future they might add it. There are also a couple of different DVD options that come up for me when I do searches in English or in Czech, but I can't speak to their regions. Also, the version that we had access to still had a lot of 70s grime to the film quality, which I still think looks great. I mean, it still, in a way, adds to the experience of watching a film from this era and with this this theme to it. Still looks great. But I just wanted to highlight that as well, so that you're not out there looking for some sort of immaculate version of it, some immaculate restoration that does not exist.
Well, yeah. And I would just say, this film has a fuzzier baseline, I think, than some of the other movies we looked at. Like last week's movie, another Czech film, Invention for Destruction, cleaned up very, very beautifully, and it looked very crisp in the restoration. And I think it was meant to look crisp in the original. I think this is a movie that was meant to be a bit foggy.
Yeah, it works. Like, it's kind of like you're watching this film projected onto an oil stained sheet hung on the dilapidated side of a barn, and while things howl in the mist beyond the farm. And I think that works.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Well, let's get into the people of note here, the people who made this film. Obviously, we're going to be referencing a number of Czech and Slovakian individuals here. So our apologies for any incorrect pronunciations regarding these names. All right. First of all, the director also has a screenplay credit, Juraj Hertz, who lived 1934 through 2018. Czechoslovak film director, actor, and scene designer. He was born in modern-day Slovakia to Jewish parents, and together they actually survived the Holocaust. They were imprisoned at the Ravensbrück concentration camp. And while his immediate family survived, some 60 relatives, I'm reading, perished in the Holocaust.
Wow.
He began acting in the early 1960s and writing and directing in the mid-1960s. His big breakout film was the dark comedy horror film The Cremator from 1969, which won a whole slew of awards. It was even nominated for an Oscar in the U.S. for, you know, best foreign language film. And it details a cremator's descent into madness in the 1930s with plot elements that, and I haven't seen it, but we're reading that the plot elements involve both the Nazis and Tibetan Buddhism.
Wow.
It was based on a novel by Ladislav Fuchs. His other major films include 1972's Morgiana, which is another gothic horror film, 2010's Haberman, which featured Carl Roden. He's a Czech actor who has played roles in various international and Western pictures, like he was in some Guillermo del Toro films, such as Blade 2 and Hellboy.
Mm. Oh, who was he in Blade 2?
In Blade 2, he was the lawyer of the vampire lord, though his voice was dubbed in that, so that's not Roden's actual voice.
Yes, okay, just looked him up. I recognize this guy.
Yeah, yeah, he's been in a number of things. He plays a good villain, though not only villains, but a lot of villains, especially outside of the Czech Republic. Now back to Hertz. He also did the 2009 film TMA. His 1979 film The Ninth Heart sounds really interesting as well, and apparently involves a wizard's castle and is a fairy tale movie, much like this one.
After having seen Beauty and the Beast, I think I would watch any Hertz movie that has a castle.
Yeah. He also, this is a film we've mentioned in passing on the show before. He also directed 1982's Ferret Vampire, which is the one about a car that drinks blood, apparently.
Is it Ferret or is it Ferrat Vampire?
Ferrat, I think Ferrat, yes.
That might be a type of car, but we sound hilarious to people who know cars right now.
Yeah, sorry, yes. But it's Vampire Car. It's a Vampire Car movie that looks like it's quite interesting. And I noticed that the director himself has a cameo in it as Dracula in a silent film. As an actor, he appeared in 1968's The Flat, which was a short by Jan Svenkmeyer, and he has all told something like 47 directorial credits. It's a pretty full filmography with subject matter ranging from fantasy and horror to stuff like his 1986 Holocaust drama The Night Overtakes Me. All right, we mentioned this last week because František Hruban was one of the credited writers on 1958's Invention for Destruction by Carl Zeiman. He lived 1910 through 1971. He has play screenplay credits on this film. And he's notable for a number of works, including the epic poem Romance for Flugelhorn, which was written in 1961 and was adapted for film in 1967.
Mm.
Oda Hoffmann is also credited, has a screenplay credit on this. This individual lived 1928 through 1989, Czechoslovak writer of children's literature and young adult literature, and a screenwriter. His story, 30 Maidens and Pythagoras, was made into a 1977 film, and they have a number of interesting-looking screenplay credits from a long career, including Merry Christmas Octopus from 1987, which has this lovely description on IMDb. Quote, Eva and her younger brother, Johnny, own two sentient octopuses made out of strange matter. Will their parents divorce and ruin Christmas? Will a scientist find a way to use their pets as fuel? Live-action film with stop-motion octopuses.
I don't know what to say. That sounds great.
I looked at stills from it. It looks interesting. This is apparently a follow-up from a film that came out the same year, The Octopuses from the Second Floor. So please, if you grew up watching these films, if you have any connection to these octopuses, please write in and tell us about it.
Yeah, I want to hear from the people for whom this was their Morozko.
All right, let's get into the cast here. It's Beauty and the Beast, so let's start with Beauty, who has the name Julie in this.
Yes, Julie or Julie in this movie is played by Zdena Studenkova.
Yeah, born 1954, award-winning Slovak film and stage actress, singer and author, and in general a major Slovak celebrity figure, it seems. She was especially active on Slovakian television at least up until 2021. Her other film credits include a 1998 Czech adaptation of Lady Chatterley's Lover and 1995's The Garden. Oh, and also 1975's The Motive for Murder. However, it seems that she's only responsible for the physical performance of Julie in this film. Another actor provides the voice.
Wasn't it the case that multiple characters in this movie are dubbed by different actors than appear on the film?
Yeah, I mean, there's one of the sisters is, and then the Beast. Though with the Beast, it kind of makes sense, because the Beast, you need somebody who can do the voice of the monster while still looking like the prince. And it's kind of a big ask for casting. Like Dan Stevens from the 2017 live adaptation of the Disney, like that makes sense because Dan Stevens sounds scary and still has the Hollywood good looks going on. Klaus Kinski is a misfire because he sounds like a beast, but he also looks like a beast when he is in his human form. And so it doesn't really work.
Well, despite the fact that it's not her voice on the tape, Zdena Studenkova, I thought was great as Julie. She has a wonderful screen presence, and she, a lot of what the movie calls on her to do is to, just with like her expressions and everything, inject like life into dead and moldering environments and sort of restore the promise of joy and hope for the future with a smile. And she does that.
Yeah, I mean, she's solid. But her voice is provided by Tatiana Medvedka, who was born in 1953, a Czech actor whose credits include 1986's Veronica, in which she starred, plus a lot of supporting roles in recent decades. She also appears in such films as 2011's The House, 2018's Bathory, Countess of Blood, which also had Carl Roden in it. That was like a Czech film with an international cast.
Did she play Elizabeth Bathory?
No, she played a supporting character. I believe Bathory was played by Anne Friel.
Oh, okay.
All right, so that's the Beauty. Let's talk about the Beast.
Just think, oh no, what if, so we're talking about all the Beauty and the Beast movies today. What if one day we have to talk about all the Elizabeth Bathory movies?
Oh goodness. Yeah, I'm not even sure offhand what Bathory film would be appropriate.
Probably none, yeah.
So the Beast and the Prince in this are physically played by Vlastimil Harapez, born 1946. This is another Czech actor who was active on TV and screen up through, I believe, 2019. His credits include 1967's Markéta Lazarová, a medieval film about the shift from paganism to Christianity, and 1977's Day for My Love.
This is the physical performer?
Yeah, yeah. He's the physical performer. He's also the prince, yeah.
He was interesting because though he was playing a beast, he had an incredibly graceful way of moving, almost as if like he were a ballerina, someone trained in ballet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And as we'll discuss, he also, and a lot of this comes down to the direction, of course, but very piercing eyes, in many cases, just an eye. You'll see a single eye of the beast staring at you, staring into the camera, into the viewer, and it's very effective. Certainly a full-body performance.
Mm-hmm.
Also of note is that the Beast is sometimes just credited as Netvor, which is Czech for monster or beast. Now, the voice of the Beast is provided by Jiří Zajenský, who lived 1939 through 2007, a Czech actor who seems to have been more of a supporting player in film, did a lot of Czech television, but he was apparently more of a larger figure in just the theater of Prague.
Okay, so that is our Panna and our Netvor, but there are supporting characters in the film as well. For example, Julie's father.
Yes, the father, Otek. Otek is Czech for father, and I didn't really realize that till very recently. I was familiar with Jan Svankmajer's film, Little Otek. And then when we were looking at various Czech actors recently, I was beginning to notice, like, oh man, this male actor really played a lot of Oteks when he was older. And then, of course, the answer to that it was because he played a lot of characters that are just that are just father in the script.
Okay, so father does not have a name that we know of in this movie. He's just Otek. Right.
Yeah, played by Václav Voska, Czech actor. This was probably his biggest film, based on what I was looking at. But he also played Watson in a 1971 Czech Sherlock Holmes film, and he was in 1949's Distant Journey, which was an early Holocaust film. All right, so that's the father, but now we got two stepsisters to roll through here.
Are they stepsisters? I think they're half-sisters.
Well, yes, but they would be Julie's stepsisters, right? But they are, or they have
sisters. Oh, I thought they were Julie's half-sisters. Yeah. I could be wrong. I thought they all had was the father, well, I'm not sure. So
I think she, Julie's mother is not their mother, but her father is everyone's father.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have two sisters at any rate. And this one, the first one here is the sister Gabinka. This is the blonde stepsister. And she is played by Jana Brascova, who was born 1940, a Czech actor and writer. Her other films include Carl Zeman's The Fabulous Baron Munchausen and the 1976 sci-fi film In the Dust of the Stars, which looks quite interesting. Is this a film that you were telling me about previously?
You know, I definitely have not seen this one, but I might have been poking around at old sci-fi movies and come across this and raised it as a possibility for us to watch.
Yeah, it looks interesting.
Yeah.
But her filmography is just full of interesting looking films. She was also in 1973's Miss Golem. She was in 1976's I Killed Einstein, Gentlemen. And she was also in 1957's Stenata, which was co-written by Milos Forman, to whom she was married from 1958 through 1962.
She's great in this movie. Both of the stepsisters or half-sisters are great because they're... I don't know. There's an interesting relationship. I mean, so they are portrayed as just like nasty, vain, selfish haters, but also they're not fully villains. Like Julie still kind of likes them and in a weird way gets along with them despite the way they are.
Yeah, but they are comically awful too. They provide some nice comic relief in this film because, yeah, all they care about is money and jewels and fancy dresses and there are any niceties that they display are just as a result of or in search of those things.
They also have a series of hilariously awful fiancés and husbands.
That's right, yeah. All right, so that's the blonde sister. The dark-haired sister is Malinka, played by Zuzana Korokova. She was born in 1948. Just the physical performance here. Her other credits include Alan Robe Grillet's 1968 film, The Man Who Lies, 1983 Salt and Gold, and 1979's The Man to Kill. I've read a number of Robe Grillet books, but I've never seen any of his films, for which he's also very well known. But I think they tend toward cerebral erotica, which has never been my go-to genre, while the books I've read of his are generally new novel takes on spy, war, and murder plots, sometimes with psychosexual themes, but for the most part, not.
But this character also had a different actor doing the voice.
Yes. Yeah, the voice of Malinka is Jorga Kotrobova, born 1947, Czech actor whose credits include 1962's The Stress of Youth and 1965's 90 Degrees in the Shade. She apparently worked a lot in dubbing, especially Western television shows that need to be dubbed into Czech. So, like, for instance, I read that she's one of the primary voices on the Czech dub of MASH.
Mm.
And those are really the prime human characters and beast character in the film. Just one more credit, and that's the music. The music is by Peter Hopka, born 1944, died in 2014. The musical soundscape for this film is basically has three speeds. There's creepy bubbling ambience. There's creepy organ music that is often like kind of blaring. And then there's a romantic refrain that we hear anytime there's something romantic or dreamy going on on the screen. It's all quite good.
Yeah, it is good. There's also a bit of whimsical harpsichord, like when Julie is kind of prancing around and playing with the statues.
That's right. Hopka's other scores include the Foray vampire film, The Ninth Heart, 1985's The Third Dragon, which is another an interesting-looking Czech fantasy film. And he frequently worked with lyricist Michael Horacek, who ran for the Czech presidency in 2018.
Hmm.
So anyway, we'll get into the plot next, but anyone out there who's more familiar with Czech cinema and Czech celebrities and so forth, feel free to write in and let us know what you think about these particular performers and the other works that they've been involved in.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we ready to talk plot?
Let's do it.
So this movie opens cold on a landscape that is the very heart of gloom. It looks like a land that has never been touched by sunlight, even though it is not nighttime in the opening scene. So you have black mounds of earth and twisted roots and broken tree trunks, and it's all shrouded in fog. In a way, it looks a bit like the blasted terrain in photos you see of No Man's Land between the frontline trenches in World War I. But it's not like that. It just seems kind of naturally this way. Mm-hmm. Wolves howl and you hear some whimpering somewhere unseen. And then the owls are singing along, of course. The atmosphere is just dank. It is like an outdoor dungeon. And then into this gloom-drenched landscape comes a man riding a horse. And then there's another and then another. And we see it as a caravan, and apparently their delivery route requires them to pass through this hellish landscape. But then, wait a minute, no, actually, the scouts at the head of the line worry that maybe they made a wrong turn after all. Maybe they don't even have to be here. So their journey has turned into, for one reason or other, an unbearable slog through this cursed wilderness.
Yeah, this whole segment is great with this caravan shipment encountering all this mud and difficulty. And we see all of these different faces, all of the actors that are portraying the caravan people here. They all have this like really rugged look to them. A lot of these faces reminded me of the characters in Hieronymus Bosch's Christ Carrying the Cross, you know, the one where you have, I think, the side profile of Christ looking dreadful, and then there are all these just awful peasant faces in the background. That's kind of what you have in this scene.
I know exactly what you're saying, yeah. Well, one of those faces is the face of a woman, sort of covered in mud. She's having a hard time. But she runs to the head of the caravan to warn the scout. She says, "We have to turn back. We cannot travel through these woods because whoever crosses these evil routes will." But before she can explain, he's like, "No, you know, I won't listen." So he just sends her away.
This is the recurring trend in the movie. People don't listen to women who have very important information about places you shouldn't go to, but they just disregard it and go anyway.
Yeah. So we see the caravan struggling, these wooden wagons going along through the mud and in this horrible wilderness. And then we go to the credit sequence, and the credit sequence is set over some thrillingly bizarre paintings. Rob, I don't know if you're able to figure out what this was in the background, but I think I see mummified fish horses with hooks for bones and fruit or eggs coming out of their eyes. We see jellyfish fairies throwing apples into the sun and worshiping doors. We see vines with hands, cables running out of a human skeleton to power an oyster.
Yeah, there's definitely like a Flemish mushroom trip quality to these paintings, though I did not specifically identify these paintings. I'm not sure what we're looking at here, but it works.
Well, back into the human action, we open on a market scene that, from what I saw, might have had some unsimulated shots of like a butcher working and people doing animal husbandry. So warning here if you're sensitive about seeing stuff like that, though it does go by quickly. Yeah. But the point is we're seeing the marketplace bustling. Bakers are making bread. Butchers are butchering meat. There's people herding animals all over the place. There's just lots of stuff going on. We're in town, which is a big contrast with the forsaken woods from the pre-credit sequence.
Yeah, and this all makes sense because we're shortly going to learn all this activity means that people with money in the town are preparing for a party. That's why animals are being rounded up and things are being slaughtered, because there's a party that's going to happen.
Right. And so here we go on to meet our main family. We have Julie or Juliet. Again, this is Stana Studenkova, who is she is kind, self-effacing, beautiful, and pure of heart. And when we first meet her, she's playing the harpsichord, and she's just sort of a ray of sunshine. She kind of puts a happy twist on everything. Then we have her father, who I originally thought his name was Otek, but that just means father. So we have father here, who seems to be also, like Julie, he's kind and pure of heart, but also maybe not good with money. He is a merchant, but we learn he has many debts.
But he's optimistic about this, and I think this might be part of his problem, is that he's always like, oh yeah, I've got some money coming in, and that's going to fix everything.
Yes. And then we have Julie's stepsisters or half-sisters, Malinka and Gabinka, who are nasty, selfish rats who just like want money and jewels.
Right.
And when we first meet everybody, they are preparing for their weddings. Julie's sitting there playing the harpsichord and talking to them. And Malinka and Gabinka are talking about their upcoming weddings. One sister says, Julie, wow, I hope you can at least marry a duke or some kind of minor royalty instead of the merchants that our father set us up with. They're very ungrateful about the matches that have been gotten for them. And then Julie says she will never marry because that would mean leaving father alone.
She's so loyal. Just so loyal.
I mean, that's very kind, Julie, but it also seems it's kind of like overly like self-sacrificing, which is a theme for Julie.
Yeah. And I guess a fairy tale theme in general reminds me of Jack Frost. Remember where the daughter in that is so loyal to father that she will gladly sacrifice herself and freeze to death in the woods if it prevents him from getting a butt whooping from the stepmom.
Yeah. I don't know. These kind of character dynamics in fairy tales make me think about how, well, of course it's good to, you know, encourage the virtues of being generous to the needs of others and self-sacrificing in some ways, but also like you should be realistic about different stakes.
Yes.
But in the scene, we also first see an important plot device, which is a painting of Julie's mother. This is Julie's mother, but not the mother of the other two sisters. And in this painting, she looks a lot like Julie, except she looks sad, almost disappointed. It looks like she's gazing out of frame in the portrait, almost at something she desires but knows she cannot have.
Yeah, it's a haunting-looking painting. And I have to say, paintings in movies like this, they don't always look convincing. And I'm not sure how the style here necessarily fits into the intended time period, but I don't know, it works. I like it.
But remember those like fiancés the sisters were complaining about? Well, here we go into a scene with the two horrible fiancés, and it was really funny. One of them is drinking wine with Otek, the father, and he's like, oh, fine vintage wine, such a spicy tang. And then the other one says, it's a waste to serve it to wedding guests. And I think the deal is the father owes these two guys money. Which, like, these are kind of, I don't know if they're supposed to be rich or not, but there are these other merchants and he owes them money. And I don't know, that's a rough situation, I guess, being deeply in debt to your son-in-law.
Yeah. So it's not really a sense that he's paying them off by letting them marry his daughters, but maybe he's just like buying a little time. But he insists, you know, I've got money coming in,
That's right, because I think his debt is that he has a shipment of goods coming in from all over the world. He's got Venetian mirrors and lace from Brussels, fine china, diamonds cut in Amsterdam. And once all these goods arrive and he's able to sell them, he will be swimming in cash and able to pay them back double what they loaned him. And then you think, uh-oh, wait a minute. Do you think that shipment was the caravan we saw really struggling in the haunted woods earlier?
Oh, yeah, that's where it comes together. This shipment of very breakable objects is probably doomed. I mean, the diamonds will be all right, but everything else seems pretty breakable.
If you can find them.
Yeah.
Tragedy on the caravan. The caravan comes up. They're going along a mountain pass along the side of a ravine, and then they come to the end of the road. The path just stops, and it's overgrown, and they say, well, we'll have to hack our way through. And I was noticing, Rob, I don't know if you noticed the same thing. This setting seemed similar to me to the scene on the road with the that the guy has to travel through to get to Orlok's castle in Werner Herzog's Nosferatu. Just like a soul-violating portrait of Eastern European wilderness where the rocks and the trees look kind of evil and alien, as if from another planet or another eon of Earth.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen Herzog's Nosferatu, but I know what you're talking about here. And I didn't go crazy with the comparisons of locations, but I did note that Nosferatu was at least partially filmed in then Czechoslovakia. So so maybe we are looking at some of the same locations or at least same regions.
But then, as the scouts for the caravan are hacking through the bushes that have overgrown the path, they see something on the other side. What is that? Some kind of creature? Rob, can you describe the glimpse they get?
I didn't get a good glimpse of it. I just saw like a dark movement. I don't know if I blinked or what. What did you see?
Well, I mean, I saw it. I think we get a suggestion of the same kind of creature that appears multiple times in the movie, not the beast himself, but these other beings that sort of serve the beast and occupy his castle his mansion.
Yeah, those things, they're kind of like goblins or some sort of homunculi. And they do also throw you off the scent of what the beast is going to look like, because you see these guys in glimpses long before you actually see the visage of the beast.
So one of the caravan guides picks a white rose from the shrubs and tosses it to the woman who warned them not to enter the haunted forest. So I guess like she didn't want to be here anyway, but he's like, hey, here's a white rose. And then like a fire leaps up from hell and engulfs the guide. So he's burning. Carts start tumbling into the ravine. They're trying to turn around and escape. All of the goods are pouring out of the carts and crashing down the rocks and down the hillside and everything. All the goods are being destroyed. And then there was one part I didn't quite understand. Suddenly humans are fighting each other, like sword fighting and shooting each other. Is this like bandits attacking the caravan? I didn't fully understand.
I was a little lost on that as well. I wasn't sure if these were newly arrived bandits or if just chaos took hold. And since the caravan was lost, everyone's like, well, let's just grab some stuff and run. And some people were staying loyal and some weren't, and they were squabbling over the remains. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so I couldn't quite tell. But anyway, that's all going on. The caravan meets a horrible end. And the woman from the caravan survives the bandits or whatever that is. And she runs away. She runs off into no man's land. But she's chased by someone or something on horseback, and she eventually gets backed up against a rock or a tree or something, and she turns and she looks at what it is that's following her and screams in horror.
And at this moment, we get the what I guess is just a staple of 70s gothic horror cinema, and that is we get the breast slash.
The claw.
She's slashed by a claw on the breast. No, nothing pulls her heart out, because this is not that sort of movie. But this seems to be a staple of films like The Lorelei's Grasp and Horror Rises from the Tomb.
Very next thing we cut to, it's repo time. back in town, back at the Otek's house, the goods failed to arrive, so the two disgusting fiancés are having repo men take everything that the father owns. The two half-sisters are mad. They make fun of Julie. They say, like, wow, you would go out in the market and try to sell sunshine if you thought it would help our stupid father. And she agrees. In fact, she would try to do that if it would help him.
Needless to say, the weddings are off at this point.
I think so, yeah. Something's gone very wrong. And everything in the house is being taken away and sold. The carriage is gone. All the furniture is gone. And the sisters talk about what there is left to sell. Basically, the only thing the creditors didn't take was the painting of Julie's mother. And the sisters say, hey, we should sell that frame, so we should buy a necklace. But then they conclude that they could probably only get a dog collar or maybe some cat droppings for it.
They're so awful.
Yeah. So the father is clearly, he's just grief-stricken. He confides in Julie. He says, they want to get married. They'll never forgive me for making them poor. But Julie consoles him. She says it wasn't his fault. And then the father says, you know what? I've got no choice. I have got to go try to sell the only possession we have left, the painting of Julie's mother, so I can buy my two evil daughters some jewelry. So he offers Julie, as he's leaving, he says he's going to bring her a jewel of a different kind. He says, would you like a wayside rose?
Hmm.
Now, she says all she wants is for him to return safe. And then she tries to warn him. She's like, I don't know. I don't think you should travel into the haunted woods, because when she was a girl, her mother told her stories of a curse placed over the forest and a moldering mansion in which there dwelt a nameless terror. But is Otek going to listen? Otek's not going to listen.
No, no. Once again, warnings from a woman go completely unheeded. He's like, yeah, you remind me a lot of your mother, and takes off directly to the haunted woods.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So I love this sequence where Father goes to the woods. He goes out and he somehow gets off of his horse. Does his horse die or is it left behind or something?
I believe it dies, yeah.
Yeah, for some reason he's without a horse. And then he's trying to cross this just unpassable landscape. It's as if the earth were covered in spikes and barbed wire, but it's just like the woods. It's the jagged texture of the forest. And then suddenly there's a light in the distance, hovering in the faraway trees. And he wanders toward it. He wanders into a great country manor with Gothic decorations and marble statues. And he's got this big painting with him, like covered in a cloth. And as he wanders inside, the, what's it called? The gate, the portcullis or whatever it is, falls shut behind him. And there's actually a kind of disembodied hospitality in the manor here. So there's a fire burning in the fireplace, and and then some very interesting things start to happen. Rob, could you describe this?
Yeah. So if you're familiar with the Disney adaptation of Beauty and the Beast, you know that the chores get done in the castle because you have magical comedic, animated household items that engage in lavish musical numbers as they set the table and bring out the food and so forth and invite everyone to be their guest. In this dank film, the chores and the tasks are carried out by these strange goblins or homunculi that we rarely get a good look at, and they seem to keep to the shadows. They'll kind of creep out or slowly lower themselves down on a chandelier so they can, you know, pour some wine or something like that. It was one of the weirdest things in the film for me that is also just realized so wonderfully.
Yeah, so when Otak comes in and there's like a pig roasting on a spit in the fireplace, so he's going to get some meat, but then behind his back, just a hand comes down to pour him a glass of beer, and it pours, I thought this was significant, it pours until it overflows the glass. So he's being offered great hospitality.
Yeah, by revolting creatures that cling to the shadows and can probably barely do what they are tasked with.
Yes. But also, I mean, it is, despite all the hospitality in material terms, it is scary. Like when he looks into the flames in the fireplace, he sees a horrible face behind it.
Yeah, but it's not quite clear. Like you kind of get looking through his eyes, you're like, did I see a face or did I not see a face?
Yeah.
We see more of that creature later, so it is confirmed. But hey, at least he's out of the wet. He's out of the cold. The man has a fire and some food and some wine.
And he has not only that, inadvertently, he's found a buyer for the one item he has left to sell. So the father falls asleep by the fire. And while he sleeps, we see a point of view shot of something carrying a candelabra through the hallways. And it comes into the room and it looks upon the painting of Julie's mother and it is entranced. And when the father wakes up in the morning, there is a fortune in gold and jewels left by his side. So he wakes and he sees no one, but he understands the deal that has been made and he announces his thanks to the walls and he takes the treasures along with him and he's on his way out of the castle. But on the way out, he sees a white rose growing in the courtyard and he picks it for Julie. Immediately, the hammer comes down. There's a monster hand with talons and a voice saying, "My rose, I should have left you to the wolves." And then it commands Otak to look at him. He says, "Look at me." And the father is filled with horror. But the father negotiates for his life. So the beast is like, "I'm going to kill you." But before the beast kills him, the father asks that he be allowed to take the treasure to his daughters and make arrangements for their future and say goodbye. And after that, he gives his word that he will return and let the beast have his revenge. And then strangely, the beast says, "Can humans be trusted?"
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if the beast is unfamiliar with what humans are like. But the beast says, "If one of your daughters comes to die in your place, I will let you live."
Art of the deal. Art of the deal.
So Otak gets out of there. He takes the golden jewels with him. He says, and the golden jewels apparently is like good gold, I suppose. He's able to buy back all their stuff. They have all their stuff again. The daughters, Julie's playing her harpsichord, and the daughters have their dresses and stuff. But father is telling them, he says, "I'm going to have to leave. I will be gone across the sea and away for a long time." And I didn't quite understand here. I was wondering, is he lying to them to hide the fact that he is going to keep his word to the beast and go back and die? Or is he telling the truth that he's going to be away for a long time over the sea because he's planning to hide out from the beast in America or something?
I don't know. That's an interesting possibility. I took it to mean that he's like, he doesn't want to say, "I have to go back and let a beast rip my throat out." He's just covering it up with this nicety, this lie. It's like, "Well, I got to go away on a long trip, daughters. Please enjoy the fortune that I've traded my life for."
That's what I would have thought. But then the very next moment, he does reveal that. Mm. So he gives the white rose to Julie and the other daughters make fun of it. They're just so awful. They're like, "Oh, you couldn't find anything cheaper for her?" And the father says, "In fact, this rose is the most expensive gift of all, for it will cost him his life, and that only by sending one of his daughters in his place could he buy his life back." Now, it's clear he doesn't say that in order to say, "One of you should really go in my place."
Mm-hmm.
But upon hearing this, Julie, she volunteers without telling him. She sneaks off and takes one of the horses to surrender herself to her father's new creditor. And so she does. She rides off to find the mansion in the haunted woods.
Like, basically, he just mentions the possibility offhand, and she made a beeline to a horse and rode off. Like, no hesitation at all. No chance to talk her out of it or anything.
Yeah, exactly. She's gone that second. So Julie rides off through this. I think it's the same no man's land we see, but it's in a different type of light. She rides through that blasted landscape of like dead, broken tree trunks, which looks almost as eerie in the sunlight without the fog. But I thought it was maybe kind of significant. Like, so when Julie's there, it's the only time we see it lit up like that with like golden sunlight. We've previously only seen it in like the blue light of dusk and the fog. And I wonder what that means. Like, it's not a place that's made beautiful by her presence, but it is finally made clear.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And in this film in particular, some films we analyze on the show, it can kind of be a toss up whether this is intentional by the filmmakers or kind of, just luck of filmmaking. And at the end of the day, if it works, it works, you know. Mm-hmm. But in this case, with this director, this all feels very intentional. Like, there's a degree of attention that is applied to every shot in this film that makes me believe that, yeah, this was totally Hertz's intention.
And meanwhile, we get some time with the Beast, who we still have not seen his face yet. We've only seen these point of view shots revealing his taloned fingers. And the Beast looks at the painting of Julie's mother, and he has an inner dialogue. It's like, do you admire her beauty? But then there's another voice that's like, see the beauty of the throat. Imagine how beautiful human blood tastes. And then he lashes out in anger at what? I'm not quite sure. At himself or at his situation, at humanity. And this is the first of many scenes where the Beast appears to be having some kind of internal dialogue or argument between two different voices, his spoken voice and then a whispering voice that is the voice of all evil and negativity.
Yeah, and there are a number of scenes in which the Beast here is talking to himself and or addressing his primal instinct. Later on, when we actually see the Beast, there we go from a point of view shots from the Beast's perspective to shots where we, the viewer, are like a mirror to the Beast, or our perspective represents this voice of doubt and horror that he is having to wrestle with, and it works really well. Because we're sort of made to feel as if we are the Beast's human reflection, and perhaps he is a reflection of our animal potential.
Yeah. Now, I hate that I have to make this comparison, but is it similar in the Venom movies? Doesn't like Tom Hardy have a whisper Beast voice like this?
I don't know. I haven't seen the Venom movies, but if so, like, it's a solid technique.
I mean, I haven't seen them either. I think I've seen a clip from one online.
Yeah. I mean, Tom Hardy is a fine actor, but I have not seen the Venom movie.
You can say that. All right. So Julie shows up at the Gothic mansion, and there are these statues of fauns or devils outside. One statue turns its head to watch her as she enters. So that's this kind of homunculus creature that you were talking about. And she wanders the cursed home. She sees scenes of abandoned life, furniture covered in dust and cobwebs, pits of boiling mud.
Yep. I love the boiling mud. It makes a nice sound effect.
But she goes into the same room where her father slept, and these flames jump to life in the fireplace. And then again, the homunculus hand reaches down from the ceiling or from the chandelier to pour something in her glass. But this time it looks like it's putting maybe like a drug of some kind in the glass of wine or beer. Is it poisoning her? Is this what's going to take Julie's life? And we see Julie drink it and then collapse on the floor. And then there's this crazy sequence where like there's a kind of entombment, like she's in a canopy bed, but then the bed is turned into an ornate coffin around her as like four men stand at each corner of the bed and like lower the top like a coffin lid.
Yeah, and there's a homunculus on top of the coffin lid as well, kind of just hanging out up there and peering out of the darkness. It is a wild sequence.
Yeah, but then she dreams and I guess it's a dream. It's in soft focus, so it seems like it's a dream. She dreams of a handsome young man with a kind smile carrying her through the doorway in a beautiful, well-lit home. And it's like we're seeing a sort of a deep shot through a number of doorways that are all flung open, and they dance in front of a mirror together, and he's gentle and he dances gracefully. But coming back to reality now, we see Julie is not dead. She's sleeping. She's breathing. And in her slumber, we see again the point of view shot of the beast. The beast is there. He's looming over her. He reaches for her throat with his claws, with his taloned hand. One of the household gremlins is looking on nearby with this expression like, yeah, yeah. And it's very creepy. And we think, is this the end? Is he going to kill Julie? But then he doesn't. We get a reverse shot and we finally see the beast. We see what his face looks like. And it is not what you might expect. Whereas every other Beauty and the Beast adaptation I can think of that where I've seen the beast, his head is that of some type of mammalian predator, mm-hmm. like kind of a Lohenmensch figure. But here instead, he is a bird of prey or perhaps even a vulture.
Yeah, and it's a very like revolting looking vulture. This is not a beautiful bird. It is Skeksis-esque, I would say.
Yes, a slimy vulture head.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So he's reaching for her throat, but then he stops himself. He can't go through with the murder. And in fact, he not only stops himself, he runs away. Like he's fleeing, and he does a kind of, I don't know what the term for this is, but people out there who know ballet, it's kind of a ballet run, if you know what I'm talking about, Rob.
Exactly,
that kind of low running with a kind of like graceful outstretched arms and the cape flapping behind him.
Yeah, it feels like interpretive dance.
Yeah. And he runs away arguing with the whispering voice in his head. It's saying, "Are you running away?" And he says, "I don't need her blood." So instead, he's like, he goes to hunt deer in the woods because I guess he's like, "No, I can just drink deer blood instead of human blood."
So the mask and costume, I think, work really well. You see the beast a lot once he's finally visually introduced to you. And when shot in shadow and gloom, as it's mostly shot, this costume feels really alive. There's a lot of focus on the eye peering out of the side of the bird head. You know, we don't see much in the way of like the face of the creature because it's a bird. They often have the head cocked to one side, staring at us with that one wide bird eye. And it's very unnerving. But, you know, it's one thing for it to look good in the shadow and the gloom. As we've said before, you can have a great monster costume. And if you don't light it correctly, if you shoot it in a weird way, then it's not going to look good. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising that it looks so good in the shadows and the darkness. But eventually he's going to venture out into the daylight more, or what passes for daylight in this realm. And the shots like this, I think, would often be a real risk, if not a death sentence, for a monster suit and a monster effect in a film. But it's a solid enough get up that I think it holds up to the lighting. I also was really struck by the kind of interpretive dance feel that that it takes on at times when he's running around. He has a cape, which kind of feels like the dance version of flying. And I'm not really sure why this is, but I found that it did not throw me out of the experience of the film. Like, saying it out loud, it sounds like the kind of thing that would, like, if Jason Voorhees stopped to dance a little bit, you would maybe take issue with that. So I'm not sure why, but it didn't mess with my appreciation of the film or my immersion in the film at all.
I agree. And I think Jason Voorhees should dance.
But anyway, the beast looks amazing. This was really, I think, one of the first things that drew us into this film. We realized that we had an interesting director with a dark take on Beauty and the Beast, but we might have overlooked it had it just been another mammalian beast man. But when we saw that it was this grotesque, Skeksis type being, I think we were hooked.
Yes, truly. And it is an excellent, unique design. But I also love the characterization of the beast and the way he argues with himself, this other whispering voice. Like, he gets into this argument where the whispering voice says, "As an animal, you were alone and happy. Your soul knew nothing of hate nor love." And the voice taunts him like that, telling him that if he does not kill Julie, his curse will be worsened 100-fold. And so we wonder, oh, wow, how exactly is that going to work? Though we will find out later. But also I was confused because the voice is talking to him like he used to be just entirely a bird of prey that became part man. But the fact that he lives in the mansion with all of these human comforts makes you think that he was originally a human who was turned into part beast. So it's not quite clear. I wonder what you thought of that.
I mean, it gets into the larger themes of the film, right? About and the story itself, the transformative nature of love. Mm-hmm. About how, it's I think basically stated the idea that in this case a woman's love can transform the object of that love. But from the monster side, like, that transformation might itself be terrifying, because even though the beast is alone and monstrous and living in this degraded state, there's kind of a purity in that state. Like, he is unloved, but he is safe from all the potentially problematic aspects of love, the risks of love. And he is able to purely be a monster and live as a monster without any limitations placed on that might come into act if he were to become more human through someone's love.
Yeah, that's true. The voice is sort of telling him, as pure monster, you are strong. Mm-hmm. But, the kind of transformation, like the lifting of your curse, could itself be fatal to you.
Yeah, which it was, I think, explored very nicely throughout the film. So it's a fairy tale movie. It's a monster movie, but it does stir a lot of thought.
Oh, yeah, totally. So Julie, she begins to live alone in this horrible, gloomy mansion where she is essentially being held prisoner, or at least so she thinks. And we see her, she finds joy, sort of. She dances around with these disturbing statues. They look kind of Roman in nature, but I think maybe they're statues of the prince or the beast before he was the beast.
Yeah. And, you know, other versions of the Beauty and the Beast, I think, give us more of an origin story for why he is cursed at times. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever got an explanation in this film.
I don't recall one.
Yeah. I mean, we don't need one. Like, that's the backstory that is not required for the enjoyment of the film. And I kind of like it being a mystery.
Yes, totally. So there's a first confrontation where she's dining alone by the fire in the evening, and then suddenly the beast comes and he speaks to her from the shadows, but he tells her not to turn around and not to look at him. And so they have conversations like this where she can never see his face. He's hiding in the shadows behind her, but they begin to talk about themselves. At first, it's just sort of questions like, did you come of your own free will or did your father force you to come? And she says, no, he didn't force me. I came of my own free will. And he says, did you admire my statue this morning? And she says, yes. And then in the nighttime later, you hear this thudding sound echoing through the halls. And the next morning, the statues had their heads knocked off. And this makes Julie sad. I think this may be, again, an indication that the beast is afraid of his human side, of the better part of him.
Right. And afraid of the feelings that are beginning to stir.
But it establishes this pattern where the beast hides in the shadows and she never sees his face, but they continue to talk, and it's clear that they start to fall in love with each other. The beast tells Julie eventually that she is the mistress of the mansion, and in fact, she is allowed to leave if she wishes. He says he won't stop her. So there's like a sequence where she goes out to the outer gate as if to leave, but then meanwhile, the beast is watching from above. She can't see him, but he's clearly in anguish about the fact that she's going to leave. But then she doesn't leave. She closes the gate and turns back within. And the beast asks her if she is happy, if she feels well taken care of. And she says yes, but she also misses her family. And it's clear she's not totally happy. So she's being polite in a way, but he knows it's not quite true. So he takes her up to this, the holodeck, basically, sort of this magic terrace where you can look out and see things beyond the walls of the mansion. And Julie is able to look in on her family and what's going on with them.
Yeah. And even sort of venture into the simulation, if we want to call it that.
Yeah.
This is how I understood it at the time. Later on, the magic terrace is revisited and I become even foggier on how it works.
Yeah. But she looks in and it's like a big party because her sisters are getting married to princes just like they wanted. Unfortunately, they're not rich princes. They're poor princes, but they are nobility.
Yeah. And they're awful. We find out later that these are also some terrible real jerks they're marrying, but okay.
Yeah. Very, very crappy princes. But they cannot see Julie. It's sort of a one-way holodeck. So she can walk around and see what's going on with father and with the sisters, but they can't see her. And there's another scene later on that's interesting where Julie invites the beast to have a drink with her. Like she wants to look on his face, but he forbids it. And, she's like, well, at least come have a drink with me. And so she, holds up a glass of wine for him to take. But when I think he reaches for it, she touches his hand. And when she touches his hand changes. It transforms from his talons or claws back into a human hand.
Yeah, and this is key, right? This is, again, the literal transformative power of love, but this is also exactly what the monster voice was warning him against, right? Because now he is a bird without talons. He is a bird creature with human hands, which we learn are useless for doing things like, slashing open the necks of deer that he hunts in the forest and so forth.
Right. So the voice says, now the worse for you. You can live in neither world. So you are ugly because you have this monster head. You'll never be accepted by humans, but you don't have the power of a monster and the claws. Your gentle human hands are of no use to you. And the voice goes on to say, hey, just, you know, there's one way out of this. You can do what you originally planned and kill Julie and drink her blood, and then it's going to be okay. But he doesn't do it because he loves her. He confesses that he loves her. And it seems maybe she loves him too. She thinks his hands are beautiful, at least. She can see those. But she still can't turn and see his face until one day she does. She sees his face in a mirror and then finally turns to stare at him. And they have a back and forth. She at first says, you are frightening, but not evil. But then when she's really faced with him and sees his face in the light, I think she can't stand it and she runs away.
Now, this is, I think, a good time to stress that, at least when I was watching this film, and I don't know if you have the same experience, Joe, yes, we know the story. We know the fairy tale behind this. And we know that the fairy tale generally has a happy ending. There are sort of different versions of that happy ending. But watching this film, I did not feel safe that we would get to a happy ending.
Right.
And I think part of it is because it has one foot in the horror genre and one foot in Czech new wave cinema. And neither of those is like firm grounding for a nice happy ending necessarily.
Oh, I fully expected a dark, tragic ending.
Mm-hmm. So in scenes like this, it, especially as you get more into the runtime and as you lose track of how long you've been watching the film, it seems entirely likely that he may just kill her.
Totally. That would be a fitting tragic end. But instead, something interesting happens. So Julie leaves. She leaves the mansion. She returns home. And she returns home to find that her sisters, with all the ones who are obsessed with jewels and fine clothing, now that she returns home with all of the jewels and fine clothing that she got from the Beast and his manor. And the sisters love that. They're like, oh, if I'd known it would be like this, I would have gone to the monster myself.
And they're so impressed. They're like, can I wear your dress? I don't even know if they ask permission. They're like, I'm going to wear your dress now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to wear your ring. And you know, she's such a good sport. She's like, okay.
And her jewelry. But then it's hilarious when the sisters try on the gown and the jewelry. I guess they were magic. When the sisters wear them, they turn into rags and mud.
Reminiscent of the Gate 2 here with granted wishes of demons turning into poop the next day.
Oh, also, when we find out that the princes that the sisters are married to are just odious jerks. They're like running around. They're like two frat boys who are just partying with each other at the father's house. They're like, our wives are ugly. Too bad all the wine's gone.
Yeah, they're awful. And sadly, we don't get to see them savaged by a beast.
But then we see what we think is coming to a tragic end for the Beast. The Beast is pining for Julie, but she is gone, and he is just cursed. His human hands mean he cannot hunt like he could before. All of his servants, I guess because they don't fear him anymore, they leave him, so no one is serving him. And he sort of collapses in a bed, alone in his manor to die. And then Julie, it turns out, returns to him. She comes back to him, and it seems at first that he's already dead. But then when she comes to his side, we finally get the transformation. He transforms into the human prince from her dream and then wakes. And we actually do get a happy ending. He has been transformed by love, and by having the kind of bravery to surrender the perhaps illusory strength that he felt as a monster, by giving that up, he is able to live again.
Yeah, and it came right down to the wire. I wasn't sure if this was going to have a happy ending until literally like the last minute or two of the movie, because he's dying. He's on his deathbed. And the classic version of the tale is that, yes, she is going to heal him, save him with her love. And in some versions of it, like they marry each other and there's like a wedding ceremony. I didn't think we would get that. And we didn't get a wedding ceremony here. That would be a little bit too much for this particular film. But yeah, he transforms into a human. And at that point, I'm thinking, okay, maybe he's just dead. And we get kind of like that, the classic gothic ending to so many werewolf movies, right? Where our werewolf protagonist or antagonist has died, but at least becomes human in his death. But we don't get that because, again, it's clear that as the Beast transforms back into his human form, he looks up, he is alive, he draws breath. And then we transition back to that dream sequence of the prince carrying Julie through these various doors, this kind of funhouse mirror dream effect. So we get our happy ending. It's not too on the nose. It feels in keeping with the rest of the picture. It's dreamlike, it's otherworldly, but it is the culmination of love's transformation.
Yes, after everything we've been through and all the gloom and all the terror and the boiling mud and the homunculuses in the chandelier and everything, we finally do get a really sweet ending.
Yeah, it reminded me of a great quote that I've always admired from C.S. Lewis from The Four Loves, where Lewis wrote, quote, "To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. To love is to be vulnerable."
That's a great connection. I mean, I think that is pretty much exactly the spirit of the film.
Yeah. And hey, we're coming up on Valentine's Day. This is a good Valentine's Day viewing. Like, people should seek this out. This is a romantic film.
I actually agree. Yes. It's like, yeah, I mean, as long as you want your romantic film to have a taloned slime vulture.
Yes. And you need to make sure that you're not having to insist early on in the film, "No, I'm not making you watch a horror film. This is not a horror film. Trust me, this is a fairy tale. It's a beautiful story about romance." Because again, the it starts off a bit dark and bloody before the fairy tale really kicks in. Well, not too bloody. I take that back. This is not a blood fest, but there is that that moment of the young woman being ripped into by the beast.
It's not a great movie to watch if you're about to deliver a caravan full of lace from Brussels and fine china.
Right. Yeah. That's just going to stress you out. Is that one of the categories on Does the Dog Die? Does it contain a scene in which a valuable caravan is destroyed in transit?
Should be. Okay. Does that do it for today?
Yeah, I think that'll wrap it up. Again, as we mentioned, a number of Beauty and the Beast films. I think that 1946 film's definitely worth seeking out. A number of the other ones, though, I think you can safely miss, especially the two I mentioned that were not based directly on the Beauty and the Beast story. Give those a miss. Watch this movie instead. Check out 1978's Beauty and the Beast. Again, you can find different versions of it out there, but I think, sadly, as of this recording, it's not available for streaming in the U.S., or paid digital rental or purchase in the U.S. But these things change, so keep an eye out for it. If you want to see the rest of the movies that we've covered on Weird House Cinema, well, you can go to a couple of places to do that. I blog about these films at samutamusic.com. But if you use Letterboxd, which is a great website where you can chronicle films and share your reviews, read other people's reviews, it's letterboxd.com. Look us up. We have an account there. Our account name is Weird House. We have a list there of all the films that we've covered so far, with this being the most recent one. A reminder that Weird House Cinema is just the Friday episode that we put in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. Stuff to Blow Your Mind is primarily a science podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We do this on Fridays, though. On Mondays, we do listener mail, and on Wednesdays, we do a short form artifact or monster fact. But yeah, write in. We'd love to hear from you, and we cover Weird House Cinema listener mail on that listener mail episode.
Huge thanks to our audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.